The topic today is This Time It Matters, the 2004 elections and the war on drugs, a critical issue in a critical time. If I may quote our speaker, our drug laws generate massive drug profits, foster racism, threaten civil liberties, and destroy lives that might be redeemed, and incarcerate millions for nonviolent drug offenses while failing to treat those for whom drugs have become an addiction. It's with pleasure that I introduce to you Judge James Gray of the Orange County, California Superior Court.
Thank you. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be able to be with good people and to share some thoughts. Actually, somehow it must be a conspiracy, because it's my understanding that the weather here in St. Louis is always like it is today and yesterday, and you just keep it a secret in some fashion so that you're not like Southern California with all the population. But the word is out as far as I'm concerned. It's just a pleasure to be with you. Let me tell you that based upon my experience, I have been a Navy JAG criminal defense attorney in the Navy. I was a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I've been a judge now for almost 20 years, 20 years next month in Orange County, California. That the most critical issue facing our country today is drug policy. Surprising as that might sound, but our problems are so complex and they are all fed in so many ways by what we have chosen to deal with this enormously difficult area. And so on April the 8th, 1992, based upon this experience, I actually held a press conference in California, outside in the steps of the courthouse, telling anyone who would listen my views that our drug laws had failed, that they are not only failing, not only failed, but they're hopeless. And the reason isn't so much the drugs themselves. The reason is the drug money. And we're going to talk about that a little bit today. But listening to the musical presentations, and boy, what a treat. You know, you really can center. I think you're very wise to do that, not only just from a spiritual standpoint to listen to good music, but it is a centering process. And I was thinking while the first anthem or the first presentation was going on with regard to wings, thinking to myself, well, gee, wouldn't it be nice if you had wings? And then I was thinking a little further, you know, people that dream do have wings, and this is something that is nice to recognize. Then the second one was a little more disturbing. I'm not sure I'm on the other side. I think we're all on the same side, particularly with regard to this issue. Everybody is on the same side with regard to drug policy in that we all want to reduce the harm that it can and will be caused by the presence of these drugs in our communities. So let me begin by asking you the same question I ask wherever I go. And that is, how many of you people here feel that we in the United States of America are in better shape today than we were 5 years ago with regard to this critical issue of drug use and abuse and all of the crime and misery that goes with it? Okay, I see no hands, and that is completely consistent with every other group that I speak with. And it really doesn't matter the type of group. It could be a service club, it could be a religious organization, it can be a Chamber of Commerce, it really doesn't matter. We all realize that what we're doing isn't working. Well, I can sit down now, because that really is my message. Save some time. But no, I'm in the legal profession, so I keep talking anyway. I'm not a lawyer, I'm a recovering lawyer, but you understand. What flows from that? Well, the first thing that flows from that realization of what we're doing now isn't working, we're not in better shape today than we were 5 years ago, is the absolute understanding that we have no legitimate expectation of being in better shape next year than we're in today, unless we change our approach. Does that not make sense? Well, if that's true, and I think indisputably it is, then let's recognize, what should we do as a seemingly caring society? And the answer to that, I think, is pretty straightforward as well. Let's look at what we have done over the last 5, 10, 50, 100 years in our country that has worked and not worked, and hopefully start gravitating over to programs that work. But no, let's not limit us to that. Let's look around the world and see what other countries, other peoples have done that have worked and not worked. Yes, I understand that the United States of American society is not the same as in Holland or Switzerland or Australia, but we certainly have some parallels, don't we? So let's try to change over to programs that work. So I speak about this as often as I can, consistent with getting my trials tried and my work done. I have spoken to numbers of different groups. I've received numbers of different introductions. One of them I can remember very vividly, a little less flattering than Ed's here, and a lot shorter even, too. I can tell you verbatim what it was. It was along the lines of, I know you all want to hear the latest dope from the courthouse, so here's Judge Gray. But I'm still here and still talking. In any program, in any plan, we have some winners and we have some losers. And with regard to our program of drug prohibition, and make no mistake, we're still living in prohibitionary times. We repealed alcohol prohibition, but we're still living in drug prohibition today and reaping the same results of that failed program. But there are always some winners, there are always some losers. Let me share with you, in my view, five groups, there are more, but five main groups of folks that are winning with regard to drug prohibition. And the first is quite obvious, and that would be the drug lords, people that are selling, pushing these sometimes dangerous, sometimes addicting drugs on us, our neighbors, and our children. Now let me tell you from my standpoint, and I've been in the justice field really all my professional life, we are enormously successful, and I'm sure that's true here in Missouri as well. We are enormously successful in arresting, convicting, and incarcerating the low-level, nonviolent drug offender, even drug pusher. And we have filled our prisons in California, and I expect here in Missouri as well, with those people. However, the drugs are abundant still. Is that not true? I asked our kids, well, I'll get to that. If we cannot keep these drugs out of our prisons, and we can't, how do we expect to keep them off the streets of St. Louis? How do we expect to keep them out of our towns and our villages and our cities? When I was a federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, I held the record for the largest drug prosecution in the Central District of California, basically the middle six counties in California. 70 kilos of heroin, about 160 pounds, back in 1978. And that was and is a lot of heroin. Does anyone have an idea what the largest drug prosecution is today in the Central District of California? 18 tons of cocaine in one transaction. When I was a prosecutor, the cost wholesale of a kilo of heroin or cocaine was about $25,000. Today it's about half that, about $12,000 to $13,000. So the price has gone way down. When I was a prosecutor, the quality, the strength of wholesale cocaine or heroin was about 20%. Today it's about 80%. So if you look back at this, the cost is half of what it was before, the quality is four times as much, and the quantity is through the roof. So let's understand realities here. Let's talk about realities and recognize them. These drugs are here to stay. I'm sorry to have to tell you that, but it is absolutely flat out true. There has never been a civilization in the history of mankind that has not had some form of mind-altering, sometimes addicting drug to use and abuse, except maybe the Eskimos because they couldn't grow anything, but now chemistry has changed that too. So let's understand that no matter what we do, these drugs are going to be with us. So let's try to go away from the moralism approach that we have been and still are using to a management approach. Because there's some problems that we can address. In fact, we can address all of them. I was looking before I began my comments, and it looks to me like this group of people is extra intelligent. Well, maybe this group of people is well. But I could assign you to stay together for the next 10 days, spending 10 hours a day with the assignment of developing a worse program than we have, and you couldn't do it. We are taking it on the chin in every way imaginable, because yes, the drugs can be dangerous, but it's the drug money that's really bringing us down. So the first group of people that are winning are the drug lords. we have removed from the equation the people that are not particularly intelligent, not particularly well organized, and not particularly violent, and we put them in prison, leaving this phenomenally lucrative area for those people that are smarter, more violent, and more organized, and they appreciate it. Second group of people that's winning is the bureaucrats who are paid very large amounts of tax money to fight against the first group. Are you aware that the size of government and the size of the police force and everything that goes with it has increased strongly over the years, such that they are now a force to be reckoned with? Every federal agency we have, every one, gets extra money expressly earmarked in its budget each year to fight the war on drugs. It's not just the ones you would anticipate, the Department of State and the DEA and obviously the military and the rest. They keep increasing their tens of millions, hundreds of millions, if not more, dollars each year to fight the war on drugs. But it's actually the little guys, too. You know, it's the Department of Agriculture. It's the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It's the Bureau of Land Management. All of these organizations expressly get more money in their budget each year to fight the war on drugs, and they are addicted to the drug money. So if you're going to wait for the government to lead the charge for reform and for change, you have a very long wait coming. And let's just recognize that. They are winning. Number three group, politicians. Politicians get elected and re-elected by talking tough on drugs and, of course, acting tough. Mandatory minimum sentences, three strikes, all of that sort of thing. It gets them elected, it gets them re-elected. And that's okay, that's our system. But politicians are really good at one thing, and that is followership. The politicians will follow where the votes are. And this is almost the definition of a grassroots movement to change. As soon as the politicians see that the votes are in favor of change, then they will start talking sensibly and will start being smart on drugs, smart on crime instead of tough on crime. Tough on crime doesn't work in this area. The number four group that is winning are the people, in effect, that get money because of increased crime. The people that build prisons, the people that staff prisons, the people that sell burglar alarm equipment, all that sort of thing. They are getting wealthy. This is a high monetary return area. And the fifth group of people, and it's really hard for me, because I love my country deeply, and I know all of us suffered a shock on September 11th, 2001. We will never be the same. But I'm sorry to say this, but if we really cared about fighting terrorism, what is the thing we can do to really hurt the terrorists of this world and their foul deeds? And the answer to that is easy. We should repeal drug prohibition, because guess where the money comes from to fund terrorists from all around the world? And it comes from the sale of illicit drugs. Drug prohibition is the golden goose of terrorism. We're always going to have people that are extremists, that are radicals, that are violent people among us. That's always going to be there, but they're far less dangerous if they're not funded. And the thing we could do to take away the funding for Osama bin Laden and all of these other cowards is to repeal drug prohibition. Who's losing? Everybody else. Taxpayers. People that have drug problems. And our children. And that sounds strange, but let me tell you, and seemingly we all realize what we're doing isn't working, but we're willing to take these shots to the chops because we do it for our children, and I understand that. But let me share with you, we are affirmatively putting our children in harm's way because of drug prohibition. Why? I can give you five reasons for that as well, and there are dozens more. First is, talk to our underage adults. Talk to our children under the age of 21. And they'll tell you the same thing they tell me. Yes, they can get alcohol. We know that. I was under 21 once. But they have to work at it. It's easier for our young people to get marijuana or any other illicit drug than it is a six-pack of beer. Why? Because they have to work at getting the alcohol, but the illegal drugs find them. Why? Because someone else has a profit motive to get our kids hooked on these drugs. They seek them out. As a result, you'd ask them, If I were to give you, I asked high school, junior college kids, if I were to give you $50 in cash right now, how many of you could come back with $50 worth of marijuana tomorrow at noon if you wanted to? That's the key. If they wanted to. And two-thirds of them will raise their hands. That's not to say they're doing it, but if they wanted to, they could. How many drug dealers have you ever heard of that asks for ID? Doesn't happen. Why not? Because face the reality. The alcohol is regulated and controlled by the government, and the illicit drugs are controlled by the mob. It's easier for our kids to get any illicit drug if they want it than it is alcohol. They're pushed in harm's way because of that. I say these drugs are so dangerous and can be so harmful, they're too harmful not to regulate. Let's bring the drugs back under the law. There's no laws whatsoever today with regard to the sale and usage and supply of these illicit drugs, except those enforced by the drug dealers. That's not a good thing. Number two. Okay, so you have kids, teenagers, whatever. Summertime comes around. What do you want them to do? Sleep till 10 in the morning, hang out by the pool. Can I go to the beach or go to the lake? Not a chance. Get a job, right? So what happens? These kids are working. They go on a Friday evening, see some of their peers at a party. One of them happens to sell drugs. Talks to your son, your daughter. Says, got a job now, right? Yeah. How much money did you make last week? I made $150. $150? Boy, are you a sucker. You know, I can make four times that much money in an afternoon selling drugs. And it's true. And the whole illegal drug market and the money to be made from it is corrupting the work ethic of our children. We might as well take out billboards in the inner city saying, hey, guys, want to make some drugs and make some money? You'll never make as much money in doing anything as you can by selling drugs. And if you don't think our kids are listening and paying attention to that, think again. Our drug prohibition are putting our children in harm's way. Number three, happens all the time. I deeply regret to tell you. I see this in juvenile court a great deal. Adults selling drugs. They want to get reliable workers. Ask yourself the question, how much risk-taking can you buy from a 15, 16-year-old boy in the inner city or almost anywhere else for $100 in cash? And the answer is, quite a bit. And so they recruit our youngsters to work as gophers and lookouts and stuff like that in the drug sales business. And then with a threat of violence and pocket change for these adult drug sellers, you have a reliable worker. And then as night follows day, as soon as the reliability is established, what happens? The adult trusts the child to go out and sell small amounts of drugs so that the child makes more money and the drug seller makes more money. Ask yourself this question. If you have 14, 15, 16-year-old boy or girl selling drugs, who are they going to sell to? Us? No. They're going to go out and sell to their 14, 15, 16-year-old peers, right? Thus recruiting more children into a lifestyle of drug usage and drug selling. It's a terrible thing to see. And then, let's fast forward for a year or two. This kid, if he's still alive, because that's a question. It's a very violent business. He'll probably start carrying a gun. He has open access to glamorous drugs, which he's probably now using and overusing, to the degree that if he hasn't been shot by somebody else, he's probably overdosed to the degree that he is really no benefit to himself, his family, or the drug dealer. He's useless. But don't worry, because now his recruits take his position, and this evil type of enterprise continues. And this is all forced upon us because of drug prohibition. And then, I would have this happen to me in juvenile court as well, in my calendar, the abused and neglected children calendar. Maybe every 3 to 4 weeks, I would have the following scenario occur. I'd have a woman, let's call her a single parent of two children, and she'd make a very bad decision. Namely, she'd hook up with the wrong boyfriend, and this guy'd be selling drugs. So one fine day, he'd say, tell you what, Helen, if you take this package across town and give it to Charlie, I'll pay you $400. And she'd basically know it would contain narcotics, but, you know, $400 will pay half the month's rent and I need the money and, you know, I just got to do this anyway. So she'd do it. So she'd get arrested, prosecuted, convicted, let's say sentenced to prison for 5 years, and transporting 4 ounces of cocaine, 5 years is a reasonable sentence under the scenario we have today. So let me ask you this question. When you arrest and incarcerate the mother, what happens to her children? And the answer to that question is easy. She has legally abandoned her children, so they come to me on the abused and neglected children calendar. So I look at her, and she's in a jail jumpsuit and in handcuffs. And I tell her the truth, which is, and she knows this, you're not going to be a functional part of your children's lives for the next 5 years. She starts to well up with tears. Wouldn't you? And then I tell her the brutal truth, which is, ma'am, unless you're really lucky and either have a close personal friend or a family member that's both willing and able to take custody of your children, they're probably going to be adopted by someone else by the time you get out of prison. And she dissolves. Wouldn't you? But if that's not enough, anybody here happen to care how your tax money is spent? As taxpayers, you can start dissolving in tears, because you know what's going to happen, at least in California where I'm from? We're going to be spending $25,000 in the first year to incarcerate the mother, and upwards of $5,000 per month per child to keep them in a group home until they are adopted. So that's $60,000 per child times two children, $120,000, plus the $25,000 for the mother. We're going to be spending $145,000 of tax money to physically separate a mother from her children. And guess who gets to enforce all of this? I do. And I do it, but I don't have to do it quietly. You should understand what is happening here. Who else is losing? You know something? I've never heard anyone say, or even hint, that it's a good thing to be a heroin addict, for example. It's not. It's a terrible thing. And they realize it too. But if they are addicted to various drugs, it doesn't do any good whatsoever to put them in jail. Think of it this way. It makes as much sense to me to put this gifted actor Robert Downey Jr. in jail for his cocaine problem, and he certainly seems to have one, as it would have Betty Ford in jail for her alcohol problem. Is it really any different? And the answer to that has to be no. Rush Limbaugh in the news recently, with all of the hypocrisy, of course, that seems to go along with this, but he seems to have a problem with prescription drugs, according to what he said. OxyContin. Believe me, OxyContin is a very addictive drug. It's a synthetic cocaine that really gets to a big addiction really quickly. Does it make any sense, if he has that problem, to make him a criminal also? Or to make his housekeeper a criminal? Or to have to consort with the criminal element? Let's bring people like this closer to medical professionals that can help them, instead of rendering them automatic criminals and pushing them farther away. Doesn't that seem to make sense? Hold people accountable for what they do, their actions. And this is a secret, a distinction, shouldn't be a secret, but a distinction that we as a society need to draw. If somebody is going to drive a motor vehicle under the influence of marijuana, alcohol, amphetamines, cocaine, whatever it happens to be, bring them to me. That is a crime. It puts our safety at risk and must be dealt with. These are problem users. But if we're trying just to regulate what people put into their bodies, it doesn't work. And I will honestly tell you, pretty much every day after work, I go home and use a mind-altering, sometimes addicting drug. Okay, now the secret's out. I have a glass of wine with dinner. I do not need alcohol treatment, as far as I'm concerned. I am not a problem drinker. If I drive a motor vehicle under the influence of alcohol, believe me, that's a different issue. I'm pretty careful about that, as I expect that you are. But regulating what I put into my body flat out doesn't work. A lot of other people do the same thing with regard to various other drugs. And they don't need treatment either, and they're not causing harm. I happen to be a libertarian, by the way. I've just become a libertarian. I believe that people are responsible for what they do with themselves. And if they have medical problems, they should be brought closer to medical professionals, etc., etc. But we have, by these laws, created a fabulous underground market that is corrupting people in sight. And it so happens, ethics, that's what we're talking about here. Ethics is opposed to what, I was thinking. Well, maybe it's opposed to practicality, the easy way, the expedient way. But with regard to drug policy, it's one of those few areas in which ethics and expediency and practicality actually merge together as one. If we were to bring these drugs, dangerous as they can be, we've discussed that, under control, we can do away with the black market. We can increase the health and the employability of these various people. We can decrease, you know, we lead the world in the incarceration of our people, mostly minorities, by the way. It is simply intolerable that we as a society incarcerate so many people, mostly minorities. Because, you know, if I'm Rush Limbaugh, or I am Governor Jeb Bush's daughter, we need compassion, we need privacy in this trying time, and we need treatment. Right? And I agree with that. And they do need compassion, privacy, and treatment. But if it's them, if it's blacks, if it's Hispanics, they need jail. And that's what we do. Ethics? It's intolerable. This is not the United States of America that I love so much, and it's not the one you do either. Before I sit down, and by the way, I understand that we have an opportunity to have a coffee hour hereafter, and I'd love to address your questions and ask. And by the way, too, for all that I'm not in the business of selling books, but there's so much to talk about. I finally did write a book. It is available here. It's being sold by others, not by me. But the first half of the book should really upset you. It will list, talk about the various harms that we have inflicted unnecessarily upon ourselves. You know that we have lost more of our civil liberties because of the war on drugs than anything in the history of our country. If I were to rewrite that chapter, it's called The Erosion of Our Civil Liberties, I would put on there as a subtitle, Where's Paul Revere? Why is no one spreading the alarm? This is really something that is dangerous to us all. So the first half talks about these harms. The second half will give you hope. There are numbers of viable options that are actually being utilized, not only here, but mostly in Western Europe. And these have hope. Let me tell you about one of them. How much time do I have? Am I done? I'm not done. I'm going to talk forever. Switzerland. Switzerland has a problem that we pretty much do not have, regretfully. Namely, they are so well off economically that they really don't have any slums, any barrios, any down-and-out areas. But they do have heroin addicts. As a result, the good people of Switzerland sometimes have to step over some of these rather unsightly people and their smell and their heroin addicts. So they didn't know what to do about it. So they actually patterned a program after a place called in Liverpool, England, that had a program. And they actually have a clinic, medical clinic. It was a pilot program of 7 cities in Switzerland. They would have a medical clinic there staffed by 3 people, a medical doctor, a social worker, and a registered nurse. This team would go out into the drug-using population, bring these heroin addicts into the clinic, and then what would they do? They'd do the same thing you or I would do. They'd try to give them drug treatment to help them get off these drugs. But for various reasons, most of these people either wouldn't or couldn't get off that habit. So they would say, look, if you satisfy 3 criteria, we have a program for you. The criteria are, number 1, you are at least 22 years of age and have failed drug treatment at least twice and do not want to get off drugs now. Number 2 is that you are addicted to heroin, not too hard to prove. And number 3, all importantly, is if you are on our program, you will remain crime-free. So if they could satisfy those 3 criteria, they'd be placed on the program. What does that mean? It means that they would be given a prescription for pharmaceutical-grade heroin that they could purchase at competitive prices, at pharmaceutical prices. And by the way, none of these drugs are expensive. Don't let anybody tell you that this is going to be an expensive thing to do. Marijuana, they don't call it a weed for nothing. It'll grow anywhere. That's not a problem. With regard to these other drugs, too, they're dirt cheap to manufacture. The only reason they're expensive is because they're illegal. So for a maximum of $10 a day, these people can go on these programs. It's not an orgy of heroin usage. They are screened by medical doctors to find out what their maintenance level of the drug is. That is to say, that they're given enough heroin such that they do not go through withdrawal. It's enough to maintain them without going through withdrawal, but it's not enough to give them that surge either. It just maintains them kind of in an equilibrium status. That's why the program is called a heroin maintenance program. You know what happened? This was a pilot program that began in 1995 in 7 cities in Switzerland for 3 years. But after 1 year, the Minister of Health of Switzerland held a press conference saying, we're not going to wait the full 3 years. We're going to expand this to 20 cities because it's been so enormously successful. Why? What did he say happened? Number one thing they found out was crime in the neighborhood surrounding these clinics plummeted. Why? Well, what do people that are addicted to heroin, both there and in our country, do to support their habits? which can cost $100, $200, $300 a day. They'll burglarize your house or your car. They'll hit you over the head at the ATM, steal your purse. Shoplifting, they found, went down sevenfold in the various stores surrounding the clinics. The merchants were ecstatic. Because if they're even arrested, they're off the program, but they don't have to do that anymore because the costs have been reduced. Crime plummets. I think that's a good thing. I think you would agree. Second thing they found out, drug usage in the neighborhoods surrounding these clinics also plummeted. Why? Well, in fairness, let's say we have 20 people on this program. They're probably using more drugs now than they were before because they have a steady supply. So if anything, that increases drug usage. Why does drug usage go down? What do heroin-addicted people do to support their habits? Sure, burglary and prostitution and that sort of thing. But they also get larger amounts of drugs, and they sell them to you, your neighbors, and your children in order to support their habits. Happens all the time. But if they're even arrested, they're off the program. They know that. And as a result, they have fewer people selling the drugs in the communities, fewer people using the drugs in the communities. That's a good thing. Third thing they found. Employment of the people on this program went up by 50%. They were taking care of themselves, they were supporting their families, they were paying their taxes, they were off the dole. I think all of those are good things. Fourth thing they found is that now they have their relationship with the medical staff. Their health issues are being addressed, and their health is increasing by an enormous amount. They don't get AIDS. No one has ever died of an overdose because it's under control. Those are good things as well. And the fifth thing they found out is that now that they have a relationship with medical community, they start requesting drug treatment. They have that bond. They have a feeling that now they can do it. And in unusually high percentages, they come to the doctors and the nurses and say, "Doc, help me now. I'm ready." You know what happened in Switzerland? They've now finalized these programs. 20 cities are burned into the institution until the year 2011 because it's working. But there are always some people that say, no, you can't do that. Why? It's that old supposed knockout blow. Because you're sending the wrong message to our children, they say. So they put it on the ballot. And there are people, they have a plebiscite in Switzerland, kind of like we have initiatives in California. You probably have too. And Arnold Schwarzenegger won. No, that was a different one. But it failed by more than 80% of the vote. The people voted to maintain this program, not because they believe in drug usage, but because they see a program that's working. And no one can tell me that Swiss parents love their children any less than we do. But they see a program that's working. And I say, don't hide programs like this from our children. Take them there. Let our children speak with these heroin addicts. What do you think they're going to say? Oh, sure. Follow me, follow my example, so you too someday can be on a program of this kind? You think that's what they're going to say? They're going to tell them the truth. They're going to say, look at me. You know, it's a hard life. You want to see my veins? You want to see my arms and my legs and everything? I'd give anything not to have been involved in this. You know how I got started using drugs? Somebody gave me a free sample. I thought it was cool. Whatever they'd say. This would be honest education that would show our kids reality. So these are things that we could do. Let me ask you, I ask everybody, now that we know this program, can anyone here think of any reason whatsoever why we should not have a program exactly like this in St. Louis and Los Angeles and Chicago and every other city in our country? I can't. So let's legitimize the discussion, folks. We have options. We have options that are viable, that are working. Hold people accountable for what they do. If they're going to drive under the influence, or they're going to beat up their spouse under the influence or whatever, bring them to us in the judicial system. We will take them off alcohol. We'll put them into programs. We'll take them off their various drugs. And if they don't get the message, we can remove them from society because they are causing us harm. But otherwise, the Robert Downey Jr.'s and the Nicole Bush and the Rush Limbaughs and the other people have medical problems that need to be addressed. And you can put them in jail all you want to. You can put them in jail for 10 days, 10 months, or 10 years. If they have this problem going in, their problem is going to be much more aggravated by the time they get out. And then they're just going to be worse off. By the way, they're rendered a felon as well. I'm told to pat on the head and go out and sin no more. They can't get a job. These are problems that we are inflicting upon ourselves. So there's so much to talk about. Let me leave you with a story. And then I look forward to talking with you and exchanging information and the rest of downstairs if you would like. And by the way, downstairs too, I will be circulating a list. And if you're interested in having more information, if you are interested in being a part of this movement to get more information out there, to let people know that it's okay to talk about drug policy, because that's all we need to tell our fellow citizens and voters. If we legitimize the discussion, I absolutely guarantee we will change away from this failed system. The only reason we're perpetuating is this ignorance and this whole idea that we can't discuss this issue, or by discussing this, we're condoning drug usage. Does anyone here think I condone the use of these drugs? I hate these drugs so much, I want to reduce the harms that can and will be caused by their presence in our communities. So if you are interested, please sign the list downstairs, put your name, telephone, or even better, your email address on it, and I will continue to send you messages and ask that we further this amongst our people. So the story concerns a man who was on his deathbed. Very end of his life, he called his wife to his side and said, "Well, dear, I know I'm not long for this earth, but before I leave you, I just have to get something off my chest. That for a number of years now, I've been having an affair with such and such a woman that lives across the street. I'm sorry to hurt your feelings, but I think you had a right to hear it and hear it from me." She looked at him. She thought for a moment. Then she said, "That's okay. I know. That's why I poisoned you." It does not have to be that way. We are not doing the right thing. If you give me more time, I can talk to you about AIDS. You know, in Holland, they had a program of needle exchange, just allowing a clean needle to be given in exchange for a dirty needle. No questions asked, no harm done. They reduced the incidence of AIDS in half, from 8% to 4% of the people that injected illegal drugs. You know what the AIDS percentage is of people in the United States of America that use injecting illegal drugs? It's 35%. And that's a crime. Unethical, unacceptable, intolerable. So these are things that we just need to address. We're dealing with human beings. We need to treat them accordingly, hold people accountable for their actions. We couldn't do it worse if we tried. And it's time for us to do better. We need you. We need you to be involved. We need you to help us legitimize the discussion. As soon as we do that, the whole shooting match is over, and we will start making progress. So when he asks this question in the future, "Are we in better shape today than we were last year?" The answer is, "Yeah, we're doing better." Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.